Hello, welcome to the Eating for Health podcast. I'm Dr. Harriet Holm, founder of Healthy Eating Doctor, registered nutritionist and doctor. I studied medicine at Cambridge University, worked in the NHS for over a decade, have a PhD in genetics, lecture on nutrition, and was commissioned to write a novel degree combining culinary skills, nutrition and health. I'm on a mission to break down nutrition myths and share science-backed nutrition to help empower you. I'll share some interviews, theories and practical tips focused around nutrition and health. Stay tuned to find out more. I'm delighted to welcome Sarah Ann Macklin, a registered nutritionist and former fashion model, on today to tell us about her fascinating journey in omega-3. First, some background on Sarah, who founded the first not-for-profit organisation in the fashion industry called the Be Well Collective and has her own nutrition practice. Her 13 years as a successful international model showed her how young women are expected to look and perform at their physical best without being offered any nutritional guidance. For Sarah, it was a serious oversight that models who are expected to conform to certain aesthetic standards were not being educated in achieving these goals by eating to enhance their health, well-being and mental energy. Sarah has also published a book, The Great British Veg Out, to encourage people to eat their five a day. So it's an absolute delight to have Sarah Macklin, another nutritionist, on to talk to me today. And before we start, I'll just ask her to introduce herself a little bit to you.
Hi, Harriet. Thank you for letting me come on to your podcast today. As you kindly introduced me, yes, my name is Sarah Ann Macklin. I am an associate registered nutritionist, and my kind of background has been quite interesting, actually. I was started off as a model in the fashion industry at a very young age of 15. And from being a nutritionist in the industry, that actually shaped my interest in nutrition, because there was the lack of nutrition, should I say. And that basically grew my passion towards it, my understanding towards the relationship of nutrition and mental health and mental well-being, which over the last year of the pandemic, we're all much more aware of how important our mental health is. And nutrition is one of the factors that can help support that. And and there was just kind of huge void in the industry regarding anything regarding nutrition related information. And living in New York, which I lived there for quite a while, New York, I always felt, was ahead of the curve of trend, shall I say, regarding food and health. And it was really when I was living there was a huge uproar of social media and the presence of nutrition and what you should be eating and what you shouldn't be eating. And I was sadly kind of one of the ones that was sucked into that. And actually, it wasn't very healthy. It actually made me more depressed than I was before. And that's when I started seeing this real kind of fatty culture around nutrition. And I then really wanted to get to the crux of it and what that really meant. And so came back to England, enrolled in a nutrition degree through the London Met, and then went on more to look at the psychology behind eating disorders, because that was very prevalent in my industry, and understanding behavioral changes that come with it. So it's kind of not been a traditional route into nutrition, but more probably one from my own kind of guidance and things that I saw that I was suffering with and friends were suffering with. And yeah, it slowly became a hobby to a passion to a job.
No, I think it's fascinating. So do you think then, I mean, so did you look back at what you used to eat as a model, and what would you say to yourself now looking back at that? And also, was there a lot of sort of peer pressure to eat a certain way and to be a certain size?
It's such a good question to ask, because looking at myself now and the world that we live in was so different to the world that I grew up in. So, I mean, it's not that I'm saying I'm ridiculously old, but I am a lot older than most of the young people today going into the industry. You do start very young. And I think when I started, there was no social media. I mean, I had a mobile phone that you could call and text people on, but that was, I used to walk around on an A to Z map to find out where I was going. And I was kind of in a very much more naive, I would say, culture and world than what people are in today. And I think that's why New York was such an eye-opener for me, because all of a sudden there was like all these like juice bars opening and things that I'd never heard of, such as kale being the superfood. And I was like, wow, these are only things I might very rarely read on a magazine, but it was kind of all of a sudden shoved in my face. And I have to say, people back home, my friends in London, were completely unaware of this culture. And that now surprising because you talk about that now and actually it's everywhere. It's completely always in front of your eyes. And you're very infiltrated by the decisions that you make by what we're surrounding in. And I think the shape thing was, I think I was aware of what I was eating. One, because I was in an industry where all your self-worth and your financial value was put on how you looked. So it was part of your job. But I think at the same time, I was given kind of this perfectionism lifestyle. If you eat like that, then you are going to feel great and amazing. But the reality was that you didn't feel great and amazing. And so now we know that there's this whole new eating disorder called orthorexia of clean food. And I do think that in the modeling industry, that was really prevalent because everybody felt that like they had to eat a certain way to, you know, be this kind of idol that you're meant to be putting on show the whole time. And the reality is it's just not true. You actually feel worse about it. And, you know, the increased rates of depression and, you know, body dysmorphia or poor body image or, you know, all of the things that come along with really restrictive food and eating habits is actually the opposite of what you're being sold. And I never suffered with an eating disorder. I was always that very thin girl at school that hated her body and looked more like a boy. And actually, it was very, you know, very aware because all of my friends started getting boobs and hips and really sexy. And I was, you know, could never go and get a bra because I was so flat chested, which actually kind of in the end was an advantage in the modeling world. But that didn't mean that I didn't look at food in a different way that, you know, what I was around. So I think the more that my interest grew into nutrition and actually understanding the importance of food, not for aesthetic values, but for mental health purposes, was really where my passion came into it. Because I think, again, the link, and I still think the link's still quite far and beyond, that, you know, mental health is so associated with as well the food that you eat. It's so multifactorial in your lifestyle. And if we are starving our brains of, you know, carbohydrates or the right types of fat, that is going to have a direct impact on how we feel day to day. And so I think that's where actually the more aesthetic side of sadly what I was in for most of my life has actually flipped the other way. And now I'm more about actually how we can eat to support our mental health and our mood. And I'd love for, you know, the kind of younger generation to really be aware of that, that it does have such a direct impact on how we feel.
No, that's really fascinating. And I agree that it does have such a huge impact and it is so multifactorial. It's not just about sort of emotional eating and eating because you're physically hungry, but eating because you're not feeling a bit low or you need to pick me up. And then you've got the sort of the two-way connection between the gut and the brain, the gut-brain axis. And then you've got that food isn't just nutrients, but it's also food and it's the sort of cultural significance and part of your routine, and you expect to have certain meals at certain times of the day, and think about how we celebrate things, if it's with a cake or some celebratory meal. Food is so important in our lives. It's not just the nutrients. So it's really interesting.
So true. It's such an emotional connection that we all have that one food. I mean, for mine is probably a roast dinner, where you get that real sense of comfort of home. And I think roast dinner reminds me of my parents and being at home and the kind of Sunday rituals that we used to go through, which I massively missed when I lived in America because nobody knew what that was. And you really get that sense of connection. And I think we can have a huge tie towards emotional eating, it's stress eating or boredom, or maybe you stop eating when you're stressed. But again, I think there is such a definition between we have this kind of, oh, I've been comfort eating, but sometimes it's actually you're just eating it because it makes you feel good. It doesn't mean you're generally comfort eating the whole time. There's a very different clinical definition between those two. And I think that's such an important thing to highlight because shame, again, holds such a big value over all of these surrounding conversations. And we really need to kind of reduce shame around eating because, again, it should be celebrated. It is a huge socially, you know, socially and culturally big part of who we are as an individual, and so many times we should celebrate that. And sadly, the diet culture has become louder and louder and louder, and it's something that I'm really actively trying to, you know, work against and say we shouldn't feel shameful for eating something that makes us happy. It's all about balance.
I agree entirely, and I think as well, shame is such a negative emotion. There's no positive to shame, and I think more likely to sort of spiral it into more emotional eating if you feel shamed, and more likely to gain weight and all of those things about being body confident, body positive,
and taking the shame away. It's like mum guilt and shame, I think, should just be put in a box and you know, closed up 100%.
Forever. I know, it's so true, because you wouldn't say that to your best friend, would you, if you saw them have something that they really enjoyed. I think sometimes we've really got to reflect on our inner critic and actually say, I can't let that inner critic get louder and louder and louder in my head, because at the end of the day, it's such a vicious cycle and it can be very hard to get out of. And I would say if anyone does suffer with shame, you know, really try to see what your triggers are, really try to look at social media in a more positive way. So stop following all those negative accounts or stop following anyone that's not making you feel great on there, because that is a trigger. And triggers, you know, you can't stop the stresses in your life, but you can definitely help by looking at what is influencing you more in a negative way. And just being kind of aware of that is such a big part of shame, I think, and being positive towards yourself.
Absolutely. So let's talk a bit about how the gut and the brain are linked. And you sort of talked about how food is really important for mental health, but it'd be great to hear you talk a bit more about that as well.
Yeah. So, oh, gut health. I know that you're such a huge kind of advocate of our gut microbiome and, you know, all of our microbes that live in our gut. And it's become a huge area of research and one that is still rapidly growing. And I think the more that we find out, the less that we know. And that is one area that does seem to just be going from strength to strength in all different areas, from your immune system to your mental health. But I think, you know, regarding your mental well-being, we know that 95% of our serotonin, that's our real happy hormone, the one that makes us feel happy, is made within our gut. So a lot of people actually think that it's made within our brain, and it's not. It crosses the blood-brain barrier. So knowing that certain neurotransmitters such as dopamine and serotonin are actually made within our gut shows a direct link towards actually our mental health and our mental well-being. So a lot of people say, I really get that gut feeling. And it's a true feeling, you know, our second brain is essentially our gut. And I think we have to really take note of that. So looking at our gut health, looking at people with IBS, we know that they're more likely to suffer with anxiety and depression. And there's huge links here again because of our gut health. So being more aware of how we're looking after our gut health in terms of our diet is essential. So are we getting enough fiber in our diet? Tim Spector is a researcher who I really respect. He's written over 900 scientific journals regarding gut health, and he speaks a lot about diversity of the gut. And I think that's what a lot of it comes down to, is the diversity of food that we're eating. So we know that we have trillions of microbes within our gut that help keep our gut happy and healthy, and again make a lot of these neurotransmitters. And are we looking after them efficiently? There's so many things that are marketed towards a healthy gut and a healthy mind, but bringing it down to the crux of it is, are we having a diverse range of food in our diet? So essentially what that comes down to is, I always try to say, are you having around 30 different plant-based food sources a week? And that's because from plant-based food sources, we're going to get our fiber. So the recommended daily allowance is 30 grams, but actually we now know from research, it's between 30 and 50 grams a day of fiber is when we're going to be getting, you know, those real beneficial advantages of our gut microbiome. So looking at around at least 30 different plant-based foods a week is essential. And that might sound a lot. So I would say, before you kind of start panicking and thinking, crikey, I don't think I can gain that much from my diet, I always try to say, when you go to supermarket, try and look at one or two different vegetables that maybe you haven't tried before that are in season that you can add into your diet. And slowly but surely, by adding in one or two new varieties a week, you slowly start to build this up. And it's a really important one to mention, because when you are increasing your fiber, you also should be increasing your water intake as well. Otherwise, you can get some GI distress. So I would say, if you're not having much fiber at the moment, don't all of a sudden just run out and have lots of fiber, because it will irritate your gut. So making sure you're increasing your water is really important when you're increasing your fiber intake as well. So it's the diversity of the food that we're eating as well that we know has a direct impact on our gut microbiome. And then again, from that, our mental well-being. So again, it's not just about being a vegan or having plant-based foods. It's the variety and the diversity of the foods that we're eating that we know is essential. So again, not just having lots of spinach and lots of broccoli, is having a variety of different plant-based sources. So I would say, regarding our gut health, yes, it does definitely impact our mental well-being. Yes, it does have an impact on our serotonin and dopamine levels. And yes, we do know that we need to be eating much more plant-based sources of food to help support that.
Great. And I think we've got a very similar ethos in this, in that it seems to me that you're not about restricting diets. You're like me. It's about, people come to me and they say, oh, I don't have to cut lots of stuff out. And I'm saying, well, I rarely say that. I actually say add a whole pile of things in. It's about expanding your diet, expanding the variety, eating more, but eating healthier in a smarter way. So would you agree with that?
Oh, Harriet, I completely agree with that. And it's so refreshing to hear other nutritionists talk in a really similar way. I always say, when people come to me and get very worried about, you know, what can I take out and what, you know, what is it that I should be restricting? You know, my number one comeback from that is actually, what can you be adding in? Because the more variety of foods that you're adding in, naturally, the, you know, I don't even want to label food bad, because again, that's a terminology that I hate to use. But, you know, those foods that we should be reducing a bit more, such as, you know, our kind of prepackaged go-to quick foods, will naturally reduce because we're adding in more produce that every day we'll be limiting those foods that we kind of want to keep in a healthy, balanced way. I think, you know, stress is one of the biggest things that impacts us more than we probably are aware of. And it doesn't mean that we have to have, you know, steam coming out of our ears to be stressed. Stress impacts all of us, and that can impact, you know, how we metabolize food, how we feel emotionally, how we look at food, how we sleep. And so if we're becoming stressed and very restrictive in the food that we eat, that does directly impact our health. So again, we really want to be reducing that. And a way to be doing that is actually just looking less at what we can be taking out and more that what can be adding in. And the funny part of when we restrict our diet is actually it can become more detrimental. So I know you're very similar in your thought process with supplements to me, but we should be only supplementing when we're deficient. But if we're having a very restrictive diet, we're very likely, more likely to be deficient within these micronutrients because we're not consuming them and we're cutting out very large food groups. If you're doing that with a registered nutritionist or a registered dietitian, at least they can then tell you where you will be missing out. But if you're just doing this off your own back, you know, that's when actually problems can arise, because you do need to make sure that you're finding these micronutrients from other food sources. So again, it's kind of a bit of a minefield in that sense of, we really shouldn't be cutting out too large food groups, because again, that can have a huge kind of detrimental impact further down the line.
No, I agree. And I think a lot of the time, though, it's, if people are trying to sort of maybe self-diagnose themselves, or they've heard that, like, gluten-free, for example, is healthier. And there are obviously studies that have shown that if you are gluten-free and you don't have celiac disease, that you're actually increasing your risk of cardiovascular disease. So it's actually unhealthier for you. And that for most people, they should be eating gluten and eating all of those healthy foods that contain gluten, like those whole grains that have all of those other micronutrients in them, like magnesium, for example. So I think trying not to restrict, trying to have a wider diet, trying not to cut food groups out is better, not just for your sort of mental sanity, but enjoyment of food and long-term health. No, that's great. So talking about supplements then, I know that you've done some research on omega-3, and it'd be really great to hear some more about that.
Yeah, so omega-3. So this started actually when I was studying, and I've always loved fish myself, and I are silly to this day. And I know there's many ethical reasons why people might not want to consume fish, and I guess that is a completely different topic of it, and I completely understand why, for ethical reasons, people won't consume it. But for health reasons, when I was studying, I was not diagnosed when I was younger with dyslexia. And I always remember thinking, I keep reading things backwards and I'm really struggling, but I was getting fine grades, so nothing was ever kind of brought to the forefront. Then in my biochemistry class, I was actually called in within the first week of being at university, and they said, we know that you understand what you're talking about, but you keep writing backwards and you're just making up enzymes. And it's because I was completely word blind. And for the first time, I was then diagnosed with very severe dyslexia. And I think when you're studying nutrition, you kind of always end up veering more towards actually something that's quite personal to you. And when we were having our classes regarding omega-3, there was a huge link with obviously how our cell membranes, and 25% is made up with these essential fats. And it really sparked an interest. And then we started looking at ADHD, dyslexia, dyspraxia, all different learning disabilities. And all of a sudden, a light bulb went off. And I thought, well, I have dyslexia. I wonder if omega-3s will make any difference. So again, completely anecdotally and doing my own kind of study on myself, I thought, well, let's see if I start having more fish consumption. Is it going to help with my studies? And that's what I ended up doing my dissertation on. I wanted to look at omega-3 and learning disabilities. And from the research that I found in that, and this is obviously going back a while ago now, is that young children that were given fish, so this is not supplementation, that were given two portions of oily fish a week, and by portion I mean a palm size, they actually overcame their chronic reading age. And I thought that was really, really interesting. They actually kind of came on par with the other children in their class. And so I kind of delved more into the research of this and looked into the pregnancy of if you were a mother who restricted your fish intake. And again, this is not supplementation, this is only fish. And the likelihood was that if you were restricting your fish intake and you weren't having any fish, that you had a higher probability of having children with a learning disability. Again, I spoke to my mum and she said, couldn't eat anything. I was so sick during pregnancy with you that, you know, I couldn't eat, I couldn't keep anything down, absolutely did not eat fish. And so more and more research was kind of coming to light. And I thought, well, there could be a really interesting link here. And the more that I looked into the importance of these essential fatty acids, and I say they're essential because we can't gain them from our diet. So we need to consume, synthesize them. So make them in our bodies, we have to gain them from our diet. You know, I saw that, again, 25% of our cell membranes are made of these essential fatty acids. So I thought, well, there's obviously a link here. And when I looked at supplements, again, there wasn't any kind of conclusion that supplements made a difference in this area at all. It was really only the fish. But I thought, actually, when you look at the importance of these essential fatty acids, we do need to be consuming them, because if we're not, our bodies are very, very intelligent and they will take fats from other sources. So they will start using cholesterol or other types of fats to insert that into our cell membranes, again, which will probably have a different kind of effect on them. So when we're talking about essential omega-3 fatty acids, to break it down for people who are thinking, well, what does that mean? We do have omega-3s and we hear that a lot, especially in vegan diets, and they're shorter chain compounds called ALAs. Now, the longer chain compounds are ones that we can make them from these shorter chains, but the conversion rate is very, very limited, because over time and over evolution, we've lost the enzyme, and it actually shares the same enzyme with omega-6. So the efficiency down to these longer chains is very, very limited. I think it's around 15%, but it might just be just under. And these longer chain essential fatty acids are EPA and DHA. And they are, well, our DHA makes up our main kind of type of fat within our cell membrane. And that is really essential that we have these within our diet. Now, the reason why they're in oily fish is because the fish eat algae, and that is what contains these longer chain omega-3 fatty acids. Now, we don't tend to eat algae in everyday life, so it's why we say you can get them from fatty fish. You can get supplements of algae supplements if you don't eat oily fish. But again, in dietary terms, that's why they come from oily fish. So they are recommended from Public Health England to have one portion of oily fish a week. I do say, unless you're pregnant, I advise two portions of oily fish a week. But again, individual is very important. If you're pregnant, again, only have one. But I do think omega-3 fatty acids play a really important role in our mental well-being and day-to-day health. And if you are vegan, it's something that you probably should be going to speak to a nutritionist about to see if you should be supplementing as well.
I agree with that. And I think that it's really important to know how important omega-3 is, and that it's not something that your body can produce, and that plant sources are so, contain so much less of the bioactive ingredient, and that you may well need to supplement if you're just having plant sources. But I found it really interesting that women's metabolism of the ALA to EPA and DHA is actually increased. It's actually better than men, possibly related to pregnancy, that mm-hmm. they were, it's much more important for women to be able to do this so that they are able to get enough omega-3 and the active ones for their babies, their unborn baby while they're pregnant. And that's really important, critical during brain formation. So as you say, sort of one portion of oily fish during pregnancy, that's sort of that trade-off really, isn't it, between contamination of the oily fish versus the benefits of omega-3. I think it's a really interesting area. I'm sure that more research will be done and we'll understand more about it, because I think sort of understanding how the whole food effects differ from the supplement effects, what the relationship is with cardiovascular disease, with brain structure and function, there's a lot, and also things like rheumatoid arthritis and arthritis, yeah. Understanding how omega-3 sort of what its roles are on a sort of wider basis, I think we've got a lot left to learn really about it.
We really do, you know, all of those points are so important because again, we know they do have anti-inflammatory properties within them. And something that maybe I haven't touched upon is how much we're actually consuming compared to omega-6. And that's the worrying thing is that, and I'm probably not going to get this ratio right, because I think every time I make this statement, the ratio changes. Monthly.
Oh, it does. I don't think the ratio actually is important. I just think that probably
we have a much higher level
right balance. Yeah,
exactly. Well, it's something ridiculous. It's either something like 17:1 or 19:1 of omega 6 versus omega 3. Whereas if we go back, you know, thousands of years ago, it was 1:1 ratio, and that's really where we should be. But it's so much more in favor now of omega 6 because it is in a lot in plant oils and vegetable oils as well. We're getting are high amounts of omega-6 from. And because it shares the same enzyme, as I had mentioned earlier, from evolutionary processes, they don't have their own separate enzymes. They're the same one that actually uses the conversion rate. Now, because we have such high levels of omega-6, it's very greedy. So it takes that enzyme and it allows its efficiency to be used for omega-6 purposes, which leaves poor omega-3 all on its own. And that's why we have such a limited conversion rate from the smaller chains to the longer chains of omega-3. So again, looking at our kind of intakes of omega-6 of omega-3 is really important, which is why, you know, if you do eat fish and you're not against for ethical reasons, to really look at the consumption of your omega-3 intake is really, really important.
Yeah, and I think if you haven't heard there about the ratio between omega-3 and omega-6 before, this is sort of saying that really you should have much more omega-3 in your diet than omega-6, and yeah. That Western diets are actually the reverse. So, and that may well be linked to some of the deleterious effects of a Western diet, that it increases your risk of cancer, cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes. We don't know if that's linked to having much more omega-6 than omega-3.
We just know it's more pro-inflammatory, don't we? That's kind of the crux of it, which is, sadly, we don't want to have too much inflammation.
Yes, absolutely. So for the people that watch these sort of documentaries on Netflix and come and say, I don't eat fish because I've just watched Netflix and it's got all these worms or whatever in it. I have to confess, I haven't actually watched the documentary, but what do you say to them?
I'm trying to think which one, because I can literally reel off about 10 that I just think I watch them and I'm just horrified at the cherry picked evidence in them. I mean, one of them is, it's not related to fish, but it's related to, I think it's meat, called What the Health. And I mean, I would bleep it and say what the bleep, because it is just such cherry picked evidence. And I remember watching it and thinking there is always an opposing argument. And that is when you realize, you know, that you've got a good scientist, is when you try to prove your hypothesis wrong. So you believe something and you think, I really want to try and prove this wrong. And what half of these documentaries try to do is prove themselves right the whole time. And I think that's when bad science comes into play. And a lot of these have a very good opposing argument. Yes, there's so many reasons why we should be cutting down our meat consumption, why we should be cutting down our fish consumption. I really, really do believe that we are over-consuming for the amount of people that are on this planet at the rate that we're going, and it's not sustainable. But that is a whole different argument to health. And I think that's where we need to really be aware of when we're discussing it. You know, when I'm talking about fish, it's for the sense of what our evidence shows us and actually the evidence that we have to support our health. When it comes to the environmental side of things, it's a very different argument. We should be eating more plant-based. We know that, you know, a large majority of our diet should be made up of nuts, grains, legumes, more the Mediterranean style diet approach. But that shouldn't shun out the meat sources and the fish sources that are also very beneficial for our health. Again, it's all in balance. Mm-hmm. And I very much am aware of everyone has a very different financial position in their life. Some people can afford to have the more organic produce and some people just sadly can't. And I think if we can try just to eat more seasonally, more locally, so going more towards your farmer's market, or if you live near the seas, my parents live near the sea in Portsmouth, just going down to the fishmongers and speaking to them and seeing, you know, what's coming in and actually supporting the local fishermen. That's more of the way to go forward, I think, with terms of our nutrition and our health. I would say that anyone watching these scaremongering documentaries, because they are scaremongering, they're very one-sided, is to not believe everything that you are watching on telly. They have their argument. They want to support it. And they will bring that across because they're producing that film. Again, there is two opposing sides to every argument. And I think that's something that you have to really, really be aware of. So by all means, watch it, but please watch it with an eye that everything you're reading can be interpreted in one way, and there is always an opposing side to that.
No, I think that's a great way of summarizing it. And you're right that, you know, for every scientific experiment or research, you're always trying to, you know, disprove the null hypothesis. You know, that's the basis of science. You're trying to do that. And that science is always about the pros and cons, about the evidence, about the strength of the evidence. And these are very much sort of, you know, headline, attention grabbing, fast moving programs that I think are designed to shock, because that's how they get viewers. And it wouldn't be so shocking to present the evidence in a more balanced way. It'd be a lot more boring and they probably wouldn't get, you know, the sort of viral content that they do.
It's so true. I mean, it's the same with headlines in media, isn't there? You always get this quick fix, you know, new diet that's coming out or new vitamin or new superfoods. It's one of my biggest kind of buzzwords that I hear a lot. And sadly, as you know, being evidence-based, it's never normally the case. And if it was, you know, I think we'd solve a lot of the epidemic that we're in currently. And sadly, that's just not how it is. It's why we're in quite a sad state of health, because actually we just need to strip it back and sadly take it right back to basics. And in a lot of these conversations, we always try and find, you know, new ways to lose weight or improve our health or optimize our health. But I think, I don't know if you find this, but people seem to come to me when they're at a point where they need to change, but it's more looking at the preventative side. So what can we do to maintain our health? What can we do to prevent it, to getting to a worse state of health? And it's the same with mental well-being. People go and see a therapist or come to see somebody who can help with their mental health when they're actually really suffering. But what can we do to prevent that and maintain it before it gets to that stage? And it's about stripping it back to basics. It's looking at nutrition, it's looking at diet, it's looking at, you know, how processed is your food, how much are you putting into the preparation of it, how much time are you setting aside for it, other you know, multifactorial things such as stresses in life, triggers in life, how are you looking after yourself, are you overwhelmed, there's so many different things. Are you getting out on the door, outdoors enough, are you exercising, are you reconnecting with nature? So many different things that impact our overall well-being, and it's trying to utilize that before it gets to the point where you really need to actually take action.
No, I agree. And I also think it's one of the reasons why doing nutrition studies rigorously, clinical trials, is so different, because there are so few biomarkers that you can use to sort of have really quality studies. And that if you're improving your diet, you're often improving, you know, your exercise and well-being and maybe sleeping better. But as you say, it's really important that people try to do it, and it's a preventative and not sort of not do that when the wheels have come off and everything's broken. You know, that's still important time to do it, but if you can try and keep everything going and prevent things. And that's why I think that it's really difficult it's such a sort of fast-paced 24/7 news culture that it's really difficult to think, actually, what I'm eating now will affect my long-term health And so, and to have that understanding that you don't want to be in a position in 20 years time where you think, God, I wish I'd eaten a bit better. I wish I'd prevented the diabetes and reduced my risk of, you know, cancer or whatever. And I think it's about really understanding how important nutrition and well-being and exercise and everything is long term.
Definitely. I do think it's so hard when you're, you know, in your early teens or in your 20s to actually think the impact of that's going to have on your health. And I was giving a workshop last week and some kind of young adults in there were saying, oh, I've been on the FODMAP diet, which we know you have to be on for not a very long period of time. You have to be with a dietitian and it has to be, you know, 6 weeks of exclusion. And then you start, you slowly start bringing the foods back in. And he'd basically just heard from a dietitian what he should be doing and then never went back and has been on and off it for 2 years, too scared to touch calcium. Again, he's darker skin, so that's going to be affecting his vitamin D absorption if he's low in calcium. And it's all these small things where how important the important role that calcium plays within our diet, especially as we age and the importance of our bone health. And, you know, taking out large food groups or different micronutrients when you're younger. We're so far-fetched to talk about osteomalacia, osteoporosis, longer term down the line, but these things do occur. And again, things like, you know, weight training and the importance of certain nutrients within your diet do play a really important role longer term. And I think that's something that when you're younger, you do think you're invincible and it's never going to happen, but sadly it does.
You do, in the same way that I think people, you know, see their horrendous pictures on the side of a cigarette packet and they, it's, you don't think, oh, that's, I'm going so to get true. Lung cancer if I smoke, but there's a good chance that you might, or you certainly significantly increasing your risk of it. So if you're not shocked by those images, it's unlikely that you're going to realize the impact of nutrition. But I think it's a really important message, and I hope now with sort of nutrition in schools, and I sort of see that through my own children, that people are more, well, certainly as well, thinking about when we talked earlier about how different it was back when you were in the fashion industry. I certainly wasn't a model or in the fashion industry, but life was very different, I think, in my childhood. As you say, there were no smartphones. I didn't have, you know, all that information. I wasn't bombarded by it so much. But I think that hopefully nutrition sort of support and the understanding and the microbiota, all of those things are having a sort of trickle down effect, and we're going into schools now and children understand a lot more, and we are, you know, improving the diet of our children. It's sort of, that's what I hope, but whether we can counteract obesity crisis is tricky.
I really think nutrition in school should be compulsory. I do a lot of workshops with my BeWare Collective. So that's a not-for-profit organization that I have that supports young adults' mental health. And I go in regularly to speak to schools around the importance of nutrition. And I think, you know, education is and knowledge is such a powerful thing. And it's one of the things that we should all be leaving our school with life skills such as nutrition and how to cook and how to implement that when you leave, because it does have such a big impact on us throughout our whole lifespan, yet it's something that's not in the curriculum. And luckily, you know, I'm sure that your children are going to grow up with such an array of knowledge because they have a mother like you who is going to teach them that. But sadly, you know, so many people don't have that, and I think it's such an important part of school's curriculum to have nutrition, and I hope that it does come into schools more.
No, I do too. I really hope so. If we just sort of think then about mental health, have you seen much of a change in your clientele over the last year, and do you think that's been linked to what they've eaten and the stresses of the pandemic? I mean, have you noticed that sort of firsthand?
Yeah, absolutely. I think so. For my kind of clients, a lot of people come to me with disordered eating, and that has definitely arisen in the last year. I mean, it's been huge. We've had a massive spike of people struggling with eating disorders. So if people that had been struggling with eating disorders have been struggling even more so, and sadly there's less and less help for these types of people. I think people that even never ever suffered with eating disorders have all of a sudden, it's become a real crux of a problem for so many. Mental health has declined rapidly over the last year for everyone. And I think that's one thing that's really come to light from this pandemic is actually you haven't got to have ill mental health to get help. Everyone has mental health, and it's about trying to support that. And when we're hit with something such as the pandemic, we all suffer, and we all then start to realize actually what it's like to suffer with bad mental well-being. Mm. Within the clinic, I mean, absolutely, I see more and more people confused about what they're meant to be eating, worrying about what they're meant to be eating, emotional eating, binge eating, but also anorexia nervosa as well has really risen. You know, anorexia nervosa is actually normally only 8% of the total kind of makeup of eating disorders. There's so many different types of disordered eating, but anorexia nervosa has definitely kind of shot up in the last year. And I think a large part of it is because, you know, no one knows what's happening. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't have any control over the situation. We've all of a sudden woken up and we're in a completely different lifestyle to what we were, you know, back in 2019. Mm-hmm. So many of us have financial insecurity, job losses, lost friends and family. And even if we're not going through that ourselves, someone that we know or love is going through that, which affects us directly. So even if you haven't lost your job or you haven't kind of had ill health, I'm sure there's someone that you know or you love that has had that. And again, that has a massive effect on how we feel day to day and how we deal with that. And food is one way of dealing with that. So
one way of controlling it, I think, you know, that you get to bring the control back into your life by controlling it. Now, I learned the other day about mirror neurons, that if you see someone else or another animal experiencing a stressful circumstance, actually you feel it in your brain, which is really, and I think it's sort of evolutionary way that emotions is sort of empathy and how we sort of evolve to have those feelings. So it's really fascinating because I think, as you say, you might not have been directly involved by COVID in that you might not have been sick or family members or things, but you will know someone else who has suffered from it. And that, you know, if those mirror neurons are firing, it's going to be stressful for you as well. And I think it's been stressful for a huge number of people. And it's one thing you can control is what you eat. And it's easier to go down that path when you're feeling stressed.
Absolutely. And I don't think we've seen the full effects of the pandemic yet. I think we're still kind of going to see a large aftermath of how many people have suffered and to the severity of it. Mm. I don't quite think we're there yet at the peak. I think that's definitely to come, which is, you know, which does take me to the point where more support is needed, more, you know, more support around practitioners, more nutritionists, dietitians, around supporting the public with whether it's eating disorders or with a healthy relationship to food, or of finding a balanced way to reduce, which is the other end of the section of obesity. Mm. You know, they're all different areas that need to be supported. And I don't quite think we're there yet in our strategy. I think there's types of interventions that are starting to be made, but I still think we've got a long way to go yet.
No, I agree. So we've talked a bit about supplements, and it'd just be really great to hear your thoughts on what I commonly am asked for. I know my opinion, and we just talked about that on your podcast, but it'd be great to hear how you define a quality supplement.
Yeah, it's such a big area, isn't it? Supplements. It's one of the biggest grossing markets. And I think that is probably the key word, is that actually it's a huge money maker. It's very clever in their marketing. And I think that's what it comes down to. If people can make money from something and it's sellable, they will. Supplements do have, you know, there is a area where they are useful. And I don't want to completely banish supplements and say that they're all awful, because they're not. They do definitely have their area where they are needed, but they're a supplement for a reason, because they're meant to supplement you if you're deficient. So you have a very, very, very similar view on this, which is really nice to hear, because I'm not an advocate of supplements. If you are a vegan, you will probably need supplement. If you are somebody who is at a high risk of vitamin D deficiency in the summer months, so you might be of, you know, a specific ethnic minority, so you have darker skin, so you really struggle to make that conversion of the vitamin D UVA rays. And also if you're elderly or if you're pregnant, you know, there are certain at-risk groups that need to look at supplementation, and that is when you need to go and see somebody who will help advise you on that. But when it comes to it, we are all so individual that we shouldn't be reading a headline or looking at something on the internet and diagnosing ourselves and walking in and buying every supplement under the sun to make us feel better, because ultimately that's not how it works. You know, how I look at health is we should be trying to gain everything we can from our diet. And if we can't, why is that? why can we not gain it from our diet? Is it because we have a male absorption issue? Is it because we have a chronic health condition that actually we need to have supplements? So people like IBD sufferers, like Crohn's and colitis, is there an absorption issue there? And if there is, do we need to supplement? But if we don't have any of these kind of chronic health conditions and we're not having a severely restrictive diet, we shouldn't need to be supplementing within our day-to-day health. If you are worried, I would say first of all, go to your GP, get a blood test, see if you are deficient in any of your micronutrients, or see if you are worried about a specific health condition. And then from there, you'll be able to make, you know, your decision on whether you feel like it is important to supplement. You know, if you are severely deficient in vitamin D, you'll be needing to have a higher dose of vitamin D. However, if you're not severely deficient in vitamin D and you're putting on an extremely high dose of vitamin D, it can become toxic. And again, what I see regularly in clinic, and I'm really sure that you do as well, is people come in with such an array of supplements. And the worry here is that they're mixing supplements. So they'll be having a multivitamin with vitamin A in it, and then they'll be having another vitamin that's got vitamin A in it, another vitamin that's got that vitamin A in it. And before you know it, they're having such high doses of this one vitamin A that we know is toxic in high doses, which is why even in the food side of things, if you're pregnant, you're told not to have liver because it's got very high vitamin A. So we don't want to be having a whole array of different supplements that all could be having the same micronutrient within it in different doses. And before we know it, it's become quite toxic to us. So again, my kind of view on supplements is if you have a very restricted diet, you might need it. But again, I would really try to say trying to open your diet unless you have a severe health condition, which means that you can't. And then go and see somebody who is a nutritionist, dietitian, or GP who can look more at your diet and see if you do need supplements. But the overall kind of arching view is hopefully, if you're listening to myself or Harriet, you're having a really balanced diet, you're embracing your food, and you're not restricting it, which means you shouldn't need supplements.
Absolutely. And I also think as well that not just sort of the toxic side effects of these fat soluble vitamins and taking too much of them, but also if you're taking too much of, or you're hyper supplementing a water soluble vitamin like vitamin C, you're just going to be weighing it out. I mean, that's the crux of it.
Yeah, you're going to be weighing it out. And also high doses of vitamin C gives you really bad GI distress. So you can have quite quick bowel movements of diarrhea. And I mean, no one really wants that.
But I think people so hate being unwell with a cold or a virus. And it's so much nicer to think, oh, well, if I take this vitamin C, then I'm going to be better quicker. The evidence just isn't there. You know, there's a big Cochrane review, and that just showed that vitamin C didn't help you to get better quicker, didn't prevent viral infection, except in one small group of people that were having very high intensity exercise. So for most of us, that's not us, and there's no evidence to support that. So I think it's try not to waste your money on lots of supplements, because most of the time you're just either you don't need them or you're just weighing them out.
Oh, it's so true. I mean, people are like, why is my wee luminous? And I'm thinking, it's because these are water soluble vitamins and you are peeing them out effectively. It's the same as protein. You can only synthesize 30 grams of protein in one sitting. So it's the same as, you know, your protein shakes, that again, you will just will be weeing them out. And I think the really, you mentioned the Cochrane review there, and it's true. This myth came from the endurance athletes that they found that if they were having high doses of vitamin C in these endurance athletes, that they were reducing their cold symptoms, but by a day.
Yes,
it wasn't even by, like, you know, it wasn't stopping them, preventing them getting a cold. It was such a small window. And it was because, again, they were having such excessive exercise that they were probably depleting their stores much quicker than an average person. So they were naturally needing more vitamin C within their diet, as they would need more calories or fat or carbohydrates in their diet, because they are using them and expanding them much more quickly than, you know, your average Joe like you or I. Mm-hmm. And so again, you know, there's a lot of people that go out and take high doses of vitamin C, but the worry of that is it does cause a lot of GI distress and a lot of tummy problems as well.
And you mentioned protein supplements as well. I mean, if you eat anything in excess, you just convert it to fat. Protein's not magical. It's not going to just continuously build up your muscles. You'll just convert it to fat if you've got it in excess. So I think as well, it's just sort of I guess it's understanding really what the pros and cons of these things are, which is not always very clear because there's that great marketing drive and that marketing message. So it's about really understanding that. So
it's I think it's such a sad thing, isn't it? Because, you know, we work in this day in, day out, so it's quite easy for us to kind of see that. And even sometimes I get misconstrued by something and I think, well, I just need to look into this to see actually what is the evidence here. But, you know, for people that don't study it, because it's not their job, the impact of marketing is so much that I really do feel for most people going into the supermarket trying to navigate the shelves of what is true and what is not. Because again, their marketing can be very clever and very, very, very powerful.
Oh, I agree. And there are so many conflicting messages. So many. Oh, great. It's been such a pleasure having you on to talk about all of those, conflicting messages, nutrition myths and about omega-3 and your take on lots of different things. So it's been really fascinating. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on. It was really wonderful to talk to you.
And I'll obviously be putting links to Sarah in the show notes, but if you could just tell us how people can find you, that'd be great.
Yeah, absolutely. So my personal Instagram, which is very nutrition focused and lifestyle focused, I would say, is Sarah Ann with ANN Macklin. And then my not-for-profit organization, which supports mental well-being, is BE_well_collective. And that is a site where we have our Instagram and our website's linked to that. We've got lots of resources from all different practitioners and clinical experts regarding mental health, nutrition, dietetics, psychology, psychotherapy. So if you kind of need any further support or just any extra resources, I'd highly recommend to go and check that out.
Yeah, and you've got lots of really great resources on your personal website as well as the Be Collective.
So, the Be Well.
Yeah, the yes. Be Well Collective. So I think, you know, I'd recommend anyone go and check out Sarah's and both her sites. They've got lots of really useful information, and follow her on Instagram.
Thank you so much.
It's such a pleasure. Thank you. I really hope you enjoyed listening, and I'd love if you'd give me a 5-star review and subscribe so that other people can find me too. I'm also at Healthy Eating Doctor on Instagram, and I have lots more nutrition education information on both my video courses and on my website, healthyeatingdoctor.com.